Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to be with you today. Coming up, we're going to talk in the next hour about President Biden's creation of a task force through executive orders to look at U.S. immigration and refugee policies. Of course, the new president seeking to undo the policies of his predecessor. We'll get into the details coming up next hour on Air Talk. But first, we begin with the very latest on COVID-19. Always a pleasure to be able to introduce to you Huntington Hospital in Pasadena's infectious disease specialist, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Dr. Schreiner, very good morning to you.
And likewise to you, Larry.
Let's start first with some good news for the global fight against COVID-19 out of the UK, where researchers were studying a Russian vaccine that already had apparently been in wide use in Russia. It's known as Sputnik V. And the British researchers found it was safe and quite effective. How big a deal is this for global distribution of vaccines?
Well, I think any vaccines that show efficacy are a really big deal. That's just one more notch in our sort of belt against this virus. And I think that this is an adenovirus-based vaccine similar to the Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca vaccines. The interesting thing about this one is that they actually use two different adenoviruses. It's also a two-dose vaccine, but the second dose is a different base virus than the first dose, which is different from the AstraZeneca. And that seems to have boosted its efficacy. It's good news. There was a lot of criticism of Russia because the phase 3 trials were very small and very quick. And so there was a lot of concern that this vaccine had not been well studied. But I think that's great news for all of us. We'll take it. If it works, that's great. And it's going to be a vaccine that can be used around the world in addition to all the others that are coming out.
Do you think there's much chance that it would be added to the vaccine arsenal here?
That's a very good question. I think we have enough different types of vaccines. If it obviously shows superiority in some fashion that we haven't yet seen, then that might be. I think we need to be open to all possibilities. This is a global pandemic. It has to have a global solution. And so I think that it'll just sort of depend on whether it proves to be more efficacious than some of the ones that we have or more available. I'm certainly open to expanding our borders when it comes to that. I think we have a desperate need of getting vaccines into underserved countries, and I know the Russians have been participating in some trials with that. So,
Dr. Schreiner, let's talk about vaccine distribution here in Southern California. You have a number of different stakeholders who are arguing different things about what needs to be prioritized. Rural areas say that they're just not getting per capita funding to do vaccination and that as a result, they're having a very difficult time getting their older population vaccinated. Those who are working on behalf of communities of color say that they're having a difficult time both, you know, convincing people to get vaccinated and dealing with all the different logistical and economic challenges that people face in some of those Southern California communities. What do you think are the best ways to address this, given, you know, we are dealing with a shortage? Not every group of people is as anxious to get the vaccine as others, and the risk isn't the same, you know, group to group. How do we resolve all these competing forces?
Well, now you see how complicated this is. I think all of us knew that this was going to be a Herculean task. You hear that word all the time because it is. It's Herculean. It's just we've never, ever done this before to provide very quickly a safe vaccines for the entire world. And so I think it doesn't surprise me that we're having complications. And I think it also comes on the heels of a pretty disorganized response in the previous administration, although they certainly helped get the vaccines through, and so that really is a credit to them. I'm hoping that the Biden administration, they are making a great effort to try to get this more organized and efficient. I think we do have to be patient. I think it is very likely that by the spring, many, many people, if not most of the people who want a vaccine, will have access to one. But it is going to be difficult in terms of the logistics because there's the two vaccines we have most available right now still require fairly robust cold storage. And Pfizer more than the Moderna, of course. They're both two-part vaccines, and the United States has been committed to completing the second vaccine, unlike some countries. And I think it's hard to get into areas where there's very little people who can actually put the jabs in the arms, as we say. So recruiting nursing students, veterinarians, veterinary students, EMTs, I mean, that's all going to be part of the parcel, and you have to be creative. And I think the fact there hasn't been a sort of a organized central federal response has put states in bad places where they have to try to create this themselves. So I'm hoping that this will begin to smooth out as we move forward. You know, we've got 30 million people who have been vaccinated, which is pretty good. Now we have to get, you know, an enormous number more. The acceptance in vaccine-hesitant communities, I think, is going to be a real challenge because often those communities are the highest risk for having bad outcomes with COVID-19. And we have to get that information out in a fashion that is appropriate and sensitive and respectful, but also truthful of the value of vaccines in preventing severe disease.
And you know, we're all, of course, would agree on this educational effort and trying to make everyone aware of the benefits of vaccination and the risks of being unvaccinated. But I wonder ethically how far you go in trying to, you know, twist people's arms to get vaccinated. I was seeing, for example, Los Angeles County firefighters. You've got a rather low rate of those choosing to get vaccinated there. Do you incentivize, as fire departments have tried to do, getting their firefighters to get vaccinated? Say, well, no, we got so many other people who want to get it. Let's give it to the people highly motivated, willing to stand in line for hours to get it. Let's give it to those people. We'll come back to the ones turning it down now later. You know, how far ethically do you think we should go, Dr. Schreiner?
Well, I think it should be a question of what is the impedance here? What's the problem for not wanting to be vaccinated? There are some people that just really don't want to do it, and I don't think it's fair to them to create some sort of draconian system where you force them to be vaccinated. It's very hard for employers to mandate vaccinations. But it can be done. It's just that's a good way to discourage people. And so I think you have to incentivize them, educate them, and encourage them. And I think there is something to sort of be said for sort of peer pressure as more and more people get vaccinated and kind of say, hey, this is safe. I feel better. This is an optimistic thing. It's changed my whole ability to deal with this pandemic. Then more people will come on board. And I think so you have to do it in a careful, respectful way, but also an effective way. You know, should you vaccinate high-risk people first? I still think that is important, even though we, you know, from an epidemiologic standpoint, you want to get as many people vaccinated as possible. But I do think that we have to protect our vulnerable populations. We have to protect the populations that are most likely to have a bad outcome if they get COVID. And so it's just going to be different efforts. You have to have people who are from those communities who can stand up and say, I'm going to get vaccinated. You should, too. We have to have celebrity input. We have to have scientific input. And it's challenging. This is difficult time for a lot of people. So I think we have to be respectful of that.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena. One of the great mysteries about the vaccination process is where the vaccine is coming from, what the chain of custody is along the way, who's deciding how doses are allocated. All of this is tremendously opaque, Dr. Schreiner. You know, I talk about this every day, and I've had so many people ask me. So, again, how is the prioritization for which jurisdictions, which health departments get one? And I can't answer the question, and this is something I live with every day. So, you know, how is the public supposed to have trust in the fairness of what's going on when we don't even know what's happening?
I do think that's an area that we need some improvement in terms of information and sort of transparency, as you say. So the way it's supposed to go, again, having a centralized federal response would sort of get rid of all of this cloak and dagger sort of stuff that's going on. And I don't actually think that's going on too much, Larry. There are people that, you know, jump in line and that finagle vaccines by flying off to some state where they can get it and so forth. But the vast majority of people, first of all, I give a lot of people credit. I have many people who say, I'm not going to get my vaccine until it's my time. I don't want to, you know, butt in line. I think that most of this goes through the state health departments, and then they can be purveyors of who's getting the vaccine. Now, a lot of it is the supply from the manufacturer. And there's things just like this big snowstorm that they have in the East Coast right now. There's no flights coming out of the eastern seaboard. So I think it's going to be, you know, that's going to put a plug in some of the supply chains that are providing vaccine to these venues. You know, I know Blue Cross is supposed to take over some of the, or Blue Shield, one of the blues there, is supposed to take over the distribution. We'll see how that goes. You know, the pharmacies, CVS and Walgreens are supposed to participate in distribution and actually providing the vaccines to people. So there's a lot of moving parts, and anytime there's a little bit of a hiccup, then it sort of clogs up the delivery. But I don't think there's any darker part of this. It's just it's a little disorganized still, and it's going to take a while to get it on track. But I do think it's happening. It's just slow.
But how are they determining who gets what and who's doing that? So, for example, Pasadena, and you're on the inside on this. One of the reasons that the public health director in Pasadena said they're lagging some other areas in vaccinating people 65 and older is because they have so many nursing homes and so many people there. But was that taken into account with the allocation? Is the allocation you get X number of vaccines out of 100,000 total population? Is it X number of vaccines in the first wave out of total percentage that are 65 years in age and up? I have no idea what the criteria are. I understand it can get interfered with, and there can be all these clogs farther down the line. But at a higher up level, how is it being allocated?
Well, you're absolutely right. And I think that each community has different needs. And Pasadena does have a disproportionate number of vulnerable nursing home and assisted care living patients. And so it was the decision, and I think a good one, on the part of the Pasadena Public Health Department to get them vaccinated first, and that took a while to get through that. Communities that don't have high levels of that were able to sort of get through that quickly, and then they could move on to the next tier. So you do have to have it tailored a little bit towards the community, but and that's where the local health departments and the city councils have a role to play, is that how do they want to do it? Who do they address? Who do they think is the most vulnerable? Do they just want to get everybody vaccinated as fast as possible? Sometimes that really leaves out the really important people, though, who don't have a voice. They may be undocumented, or they may be elderly and don't have access to a computer, or they may be, isolated at home and they don't have information. So it's complicated, and I share the public's concern about this. It's frustrating, even as hospitals, you know, to try to get all of our healthcare workers vaccinated or to participate in the vaccine rollout. It's very complicated, and we have to try to be equitable about it. But there's so many parts of this that are different for each community, and so comparing apples and apples, but it's comparing different types of apples because of the complexity of what the community might look
like. Well, I guess what I'm asking is, why wouldn't the state of California, in the allocation, if they're the responsible party, say, okay, you Pasadena, we're going to give you a higher per capita count because you have a higher number of people in congregate living situation, older people. We're going to give you, in this other community that has a comparatively younger population, fewer vaccines per capita. Why wouldn't that happen?
I think that is a problem at the highest levels of sort of the state governments in terms of allocating. You have to remember that they also have to be dependent on how much vaccine they're getting, and that has been kind of an unknown in terms of what they're basically for the distribution parts of this. They've depended on a platform, a registration platform, to get things motivated and then sort of see what how much people are using, and that would dictate how much more vaccine you're going to get. So it's been, and that piece has been rickety. I will say that I think that part could have been done better. It's not that the health departments aren't saying, hey, we have this high-risk population. We need more vaccine than you're giving us. They just have to work with what they get. And I think that's where the federal government can step in and just say, okay, we're going, you know, maybe it just comes down to setting up giant vaccination centers and just getting as many people vaccinated as possible. That, from a virologic standpoint, is the most important thing. Because the more virus that's replicating, the more opportunities it has to become more resistant to the vaccine. So there is an urgency in time, and I think that all the things that you're describing are hindering that and are very important to address on both a local and a national level.
Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, infectious disease specialist with us. You mentioned about increasing the distribution of vaccines to pharmacies. That's something that we've heard from the Biden Task Force on COVID-19, that they want to do that. Do we know how they're going to split the allocation between what goes to drugstores for administering there versus goes to health departments and the like?
I don't actually know what's going to dictate that. We had a contract with CVS and Walgreens in Pasadena, but the problem was is they didn't have enough staff to actually do it. So then other venues have stepped in. The hospital has stepped in to provide nurses and stuff for some of the MPODs that Pasadena Public Health has set up. And so sometimes it comes down to having a qualified person to actually give the vaccine. And that, you know, I think that's it's still a preferable thing because most people are used to going down to the pharmacy to get their flu shot or going to their doctor's office. That's been a whole other problem of getting vaccines to doctors that take care of patients that are, you know, their tier is up and they're ready to go and they don't have vaccine. And lots of patients look to their doctor's office to get their vaccine. So that's the problem, is that there's not enough vaccine to go around right now, and it's going to kind of areas that there's a very sort of haphazard pattern to it. So I think the pharmacies could smooth it out a little bit, but I don't know if they have the staff to handle large volumes of people. You also don't want people crowded in pharmacies as they're waiting to get vaccinated. That's a problem because, you know, COVID can be transmitted in those situations. So there's some tricky parts that you have to think through very carefully before you set those things up.
We'll continue with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner and with your questions for her about COVID-19 and about vaccination. We're at 866-893-KPCC. An antidepressant has shown some promising results in treating people with COVID-19 and easing their symptoms, particularly lung inflammation. We'll talk with Dr. Schreiner about that study. And again, take your questions at 866-893-5722. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle with Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, who joins us weekly at least, providing her expertise on COVID-19, 866-893-5722, the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joaquin in Pasadena says, I have a parent who is getting the shingles vaccine and the COVID vaccine. Should there be spacing between the doses of the two vaccines? And if so, how much time?
Yes, I think it would be prudent for the Joaquin's parents to get the COVID vaccine first and maybe put a couple, maybe even a month or two between the last dose of the COVID vaccine and the first dose of the shingles vaccine. The shingles vaccine is a recombinant vaccine. It's very safe. Doesn't seem to have as many side effects. The COVID vaccine, you know, the second shot, both of Moderna and Pfizer, sometimes gives a little low-grade fever and so forth. But I would, right now, COVID is the more important thing to prevent. And so I'd recommend that the COVID vaccine be given first and then probably wait maybe a month or two after the second COVID vaccine to initiate the shingles vaccine.
866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Ivy in Altadena asks if during the clinical trials of either of the two COVID vaccines approved for emergency use, was there any testing done on delaying the second dose to see what effect it had on overall protection?
So that's wasn't done during the trials for either Pfizer or Moderna. Because the trials were with the platform that they were going to have the two vaccines and they had to be spaced apart. So that didn't happen during the trials. But it is happening right now in England because they are not giving the second vaccine. They're using the Pfizer mRNA platform over there, and they haven't yet given the second vaccine to people who might be due. We do know that many people develop probably enough antibodies and cellular immune response after the first dose. The concern has been that it may not be as long-lasting as those that get a second boost and really, really kind of teach the immune system how to do this. It's just sort of practicing, okay, if you encounter real COVID, you're going to know what to do. So the Brits are certainly studying that right now, and they may have some data. with regard to that, that's going to be important information to know. In the United States, we're continuing still to go ahead and do the second dose. You know, if it's delayed by a week or two, that probably won't make much of a difference. A month or 2 or 3 months, that might make a difference. We'll probably know that in the next few months as the British begin to publish some of that data.
We have a drug that's been used for more than a decade as an antidepressant and for obsessive-compulsive disorder, fluvoxamine, sold under the brand name Luvox. And new study indicates that it appears to prevent inflammation in the lungs of people infected with COVID-19. The study conducted out of the Washington University in St. Louis. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the results, but is that something that you think should be considered for prescribing to COVID patients?
Yeah, that's a very interesting, a very small study. It was 152 patients, I think, but a very interesting observation. Luvox or fluvoxamine is a serotonin uptake inhibitor, a so-called SSRI, and it does have impact on certain proteins that can cause inflammation, and that's probably how it works with COVID. And I think it's very clear that most of the pathology and the sickness and the death that is associated with SARS-CoV-2 infection is because of the virus's ability to activate and disorganize the immune system. So it's interesting information to follow. This is in sort of part of examining previously, you know, used drugs to see if that's something that's helpful. That's not a traditional antiviral, of course. But again, the anti-inflammatory effects of that particular drug may be of some benefit. It was a decent little study. I think larger clinical trials will be more helpful to determine whether it's truly helpful or not.
Is this just kind of a fluke of this particular drug that it has that anti-inflammatory aspect to it, or is this something that it shares with other drugs of its class?
It probably shares it with other drugs of its class, depending on the different mechanisms that they're using. There's a certain protein that fluvoxamine affects specifically, but all the serotonin systems and the inflammatory systems are all intertwined, and so you might see some benefit with some other SSRI-type medications, but I don't think those have been looked at, and it's interesting that this one was picked. But there was some science behind it, and I think that that'll be interesting. I caution people, however, with the use of old medications that really aren't designed for this particular pathogen. There's such a need to have SARS-CoV-2-specific antivirals, and Merck is now working on one. Gilead, of course, has remdesivir, which has been kind of a disappointment. But that's really where you learn how to control the virus very well, like we did with HIV. But, you know, these observations are reasonable. If the drugs are safe and they work, then they might be helpful.
Jane in Hollywood, you're on Air Talk with Dr. Schreiner.
Oh, hi. I have had some very serious conditions in my life with diseases. I had Legionnaire's disease in 1987, and I was the only case in Orange County at the time. And I'm a little worried about the vaccine situation because I think I've also had a form of tuberculosis with calcified lymph nodes when I was 13.
So, Jane, you're concerned that having gone through these serious illnesses, that it might affect how your immune system responds to the vaccine. Dr. Schreiner?
Well, those are legitimate concerns, but I would say to Jane that because of the fact that you've had two perhaps significant pulmonary diseases, infections, that you might be at risk for more serious outcomes should you get infected with SARS-CoV-2. So I would say in the grand scheme of things, the benefit of the vaccine is going to outweigh the risks of the vaccine. But that is a discussion you should have with a physician that knows you well and knows about the history of those two infections, the nature of those infections. And that might be an argument for maybe using the one shot rather than the two shot, you know, using a Johnson & Johnson platform, which is just one shot, so that you don't have that sort of second immunologic stimulation. But we don't know the data on that. And again, I think that the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risks in anybody who's had serious previous infectious diseases at this point.
Jane, thank you. We wish all the best in making that decision with your physician. Carrie in Alhambra wanted to talk about something that's come up several times in our conversations with our physicians, and that is it appears that often the second injection of the vaccine has the more intense physical response. One of our physicians, Dr. Dean Blumberg of UC Davis Children's Hospital, said for about a 24-hour period, he was kind of laid low by it. It hit him hard the second one, and he had minimal reaction to the first. Dr. Schreiner, what do we think is going on with that, that some people have? Some people don't have it, but for those who have that bigger second-shot response?
Well, and we certainly are seeing that a little bit more commonly in younger people, sort of under 55 or so, whereas older people, their immune systems are sometimes a little bit attenuated. It seems to be a little more common with the Moderna vaccine than the Pfizer vaccine. But really what it is, it's your immune system saying, "Ooh, I know what this is, and I'm going to make antibodies and stimulate my cellular immune system because this is the protein that the spike protein." And so it's an appropriate response of your immune system recognizing what is being trained to go after. So it's normal. It can be unpleasant. Some people have had pretty high fevers, and sometimes it can last for a couple, 3 days. But it's normal. It's your immune system responding. Now, that said, people who don't have that kind of reaction, I didn't have much of a reaction after my second shot. I had the Pfizer vaccine. Doesn't mean your immune system hasn't responded. It's just, you know, it just didn't respond, it was a different sort of response. So some people tend to be more sensitive and have a little bit more robust side effects, and other people sail through it without any problem whatsoever, and they both are probably equally protected.
I was going to ask, though, if since it appears the Moderna has, at least anecdotally, more often this strong effect of the second shot, could that be an indication that it is somewhat more protective?
Doesn't seem to be playing out with the data, Larry. You know, I think that they're both these vaccines are so effective, and that's going to be a challenge for the Johnson & Johnson folks and for the Novavax folks and all of the other vaccine platforms that don't, you know, we set this bar very high because nobody expected them to be 95% effective. The efficacy of the two vaccines is almost identical. And so there may be something a little bit different in the way the Moderna vaccine is prepped, that it does something that causes a little more side effect profile. But, you know, you can get some pretty significant side effects with the Pfizer one, too. It's more of a recipient issue than the vaccine itself.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. Terry in Van Nuys says, I have a friend who had COVID-19, was asymptomatic a couple months ago, and she's telling me that she can't give COVID to anyone for a 90-day period of time after having had COVID. Is that true? Terry wonders.
Her friend is telling her that she's no longer infectious after a 90-day period?
No, for 90-day, that at least for a 90-day period, her friend doesn't need to worry about getting COVID from her.
Oh.
That she's got a 3-month immunity, essentially.
Yeah, so the person who had the COVID certainly has immunity. Hopefully she's still not shedding the virus. We do have some people that continue to shed the virus a little bit. And, of course, with the emergence of some of these variants, there's a possibility that she could acquire COVID again, a different variant. And that's one of the concerns we have, and why we recommend that people who've had COVID still get vaccinated, because the vaccine is much more protective, actually, than natural infection, which is interesting, but that's the way it is. So there's some truth that she probably no longer has virus in her nasoepithelium, but she still needs to be cautious and wear a mask and practice social distancing, because we don't know. There are some people that may either be reinfected or can continue to shed virus that might still be infectious. So we don't want to be too glib about, well, I had it, it's 90 days, I'm not going to give it to anybody, so I don't need to be cautious. You still need to be very, very careful.
Jeannie in Santa Monica and a number of other listeners have asked about what the buffer is before and after the time that you're supposed to get your second vaccination. Do you have a few days in front of and a few days on the back end where you're well within the tested range?
So the buffer, you mean, and how long you can...
How many days? Yeah.
Yeah, so usually 2 to 4 days on either side, kind of. Most people, again, we talked about, have, you know, a pretty good immune response after the first vaccine. The second vaccine, 2 weeks later, you should be fully immunized. In terms of the timing of that second vaccine, you've got a leeway of around 2 to 4 days on either side. But we will see some of the information coming out of England if that can be loosened up a little bit so that it's not quite so strict.
Okay. So if someone is scheduled to go in a day earlier than, say, their 28 days or 2 days, 3 days after their 28 days, no big deal?
No big deal.
All right. All right. Dr. Kimberly Schreiner, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll sure look forward to talking with you again soon.
Pleasure, Larry. Take care.
Thank you, infectious disease specialist, Huntington Hospital in Pasadena, Dr. Kimberly Schreiner. Coming up, we talk about what happened yesterday at the Hollywood sign, where six individuals were arrested on misdemeanor trespassing charges after they went up to the Hollywood sign, illegally gained entry to the site, and put banners over a couple of the letters and changed Hollywood to Hollyboob. We'll talk about that prank and hear from you, your favorite pranks over the years. Certainly the Hollywood sign has been the place of a number of them. Remember Hollyweed from cannabis supporters? We have much more on that coming up in just 90 seconds on Air Talk.